Good evening, everyone. This is such a joyous occasion. The not yet on sale date, which is next Tuesday, but the launch, so to speak, of Reese Bowen's wonderful new Her Royal Spinous Mystery. So Reese, a toast to you.
Oh, a toast to you too. Toast to everybody. Isn't it exciting? Even though there's no books to sign at the moment, we'll keep hoping.
Well, you can see, since I'm holding one in my hand, that there actually are books. They just haven't gotten to where they need to go yet.
Right.
So I'm just delighted to have had a chance to read it. And Reese and I will talk about it. But before we continue, Patrick has a few things that he would like to say.
Oh, yeah. Just my usual spiel that everybody watching, if you have questions for Reese, go ahead and put them in the comments field. And I'll be happy to ask them for you. And also, Barbara, when are we expecting the books? A couple weeks late?
Well, they haven't yet gotten to Reese in California, and she has to sign them, and then they have to travel from California to Scottsdale. So yeah. I can't really see them arriving before the end of next week. The official publication date moved from today to next Tuesday, but that's not going to affect UPS, who has their own routine, you know, so they'll get here when they get here.
But I'll go ahead and put a link if you'd like to order a signed copy of the book in the comments field as well.
Wait, now there's an incentive for ordering a signed copy of this book from The Poison Pen, and I'm going to hold it up, and it's called Wild Irish Rose, and you will see Reese Bowen, but you will see another name under it. So Reese, tell us what this is all about.
Well, it's the 18th book in my Molly Murphy series, which I put on hold for a few years because I simply didn't have time to write 3 books a year. Anyway, my daughter came to me a year ago and said, I think I'd like to write this series with you. So we gave it a try and she's been brilliant. She's come up with wonderful ideas. She's got Molly's voice. And this is the first book we're doing together. We've nearly finished the second one and it comes out next March. And the thing I love about it is that she was so clever in that we've really revisited everything that happened to Molly when she first came to America. So it will remind you what happened in Murphy's Law, which was 20 years ago now, if you can imagine.
Wow, has it really been that long?
I know, yeah. And Murphy's Law was still on the historical mystery bestseller list this week. So I thought it's really done rather well to keep going that long.
Well, that is exciting. I remember it got all kinds of publicity and nominated for awards and won things, and it was very good. Yeah. So this book comes out in March, and Reese's daughter lives here, and Reese will be here. So I don't have an official date, but we will do a wonderful book party. Hopefully
In person with people and hugs.
Yes, and champagne.
and champagne.
All those good things.
Yeah. Oh, yes, we're quite good at champagne.
Yep. So probably something like March 5th, but we haven't gotten that far yet. Yeah, but anyway, you can order an autographed copy now if you want. And the reason I'm holding it up is that for everyone who has ordered God Resty, what's it called? Royal Gentleman. I keep wanting
Royal
to say
Gentleman. Yeah,
God Resty Royal Gentleman from The Poison Pen by, I said tomorrow, but you know, let's give it till Saturday because we're not going to have the books in time anyway. Yeah. We're going to have a drawing for everybody who's ordered a book, and one lucky person will get my advanced reading copy, which I will be giving away to you. So, what more can I say? Right. All right, well, let's talk about this glorious book, Reese. I can't tell you how much fun it was to read. You know, this is a time when I think that cheerful books, funny books, as well as exciting mysteries come along. And you have put some real humor into this book. Queenie, you know, is always a source of humor. But one of the other things that's so great is that Reese is having a fabulous time with Wallace Simpson.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, you know, I introduced her right at the beginning of this series because that was just maybe when the Prince of Wales had just met her. And the Queen is worried that there might be an interest there. And so we've followed this relationship. And now we're at the time when the King is going to die soon and the Prince of Wales is going to become King. And we're going to have the whole, you know, the whole uproar about wanting to marry Wallace Simpson. So I've enjoyed because, you know, all I did, every research I did, I realized she really was as bitchy as I've made her. She was very cutting to people. She loved to poke fun at people. She loved to put people down and she bossed him around mercilessly. You know, everybody else had to call him sir And she would be sitting there and she'd snap her fingers and say, David, come over here. And everybody would gasp and he'd come meekly and say, yes, dear, what did you want? So she was the mother figure, I think, that he never had. So, but I've enjoyed making her very bitchy. And especially the thing that's fun is Georgie's mummy, who the retired actress who came from humble roots but has quietly forgotten them now, is able to give as good as she gets. So when she and Wallace Simpson get together, oh, it's fabulous writing that dialogue. I chuckle all the time I write it.
You do. And I really love the way they trade things back and forth. And of course, I'm always reading for Georgie's mother, who is actually not in a great position herself in this book, in that Max, her wealthy German lover, is getting too closely allied with Hitler and the Nazis. He's turned his money-making towards armaments. And at some point, this is clearly not going to fly. So you've got that to explore too.
Oh yeah, I'm setting us up for this for a great big drama in the future, because clearly Mummy has to decide between Max's millions and whether she wants to be in Germany still, and then whether she can actually leave Germany in the future. But that's a few books into the future. We've got lots of exciting things before that.
Well, we do. But actually, the other question is, you know, where would her loyalties lie? I mean, she's British, and, you know, she's had an interesting life. She's what you'd call a bolter, which is a wonderful term that applies to women who simply walked away from whatever life they were in and somehow miraculously attracted new men and new lives.
Yeah. Well, I've said in one of the books, my mother had been many things to many, many men on 6 of the 7 continents.
You know, there's one thing I really don't like about Georgie's mother. She's a small woman and she must have the metabolism of some kind of thoroughbred or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
She can eat the most astonishing amounts of food.
That's so true. I know. Isn't it annoying? I mean, she's like that. There are some people like that who can just devour food and they never put an ounce on. And she's one of those lucky people, I guess.
Yes, it's extremely annoying. And there's an awful lot of food in this wonderful book, because where we are is that we are in Christmas 1935. Mm-hmm. And Georgie, who one of mother's exes still alive and is one of those Brits who wants to be exploring exotic foreign places all the time, right?
Mm-hmm. But he's rich. He's that classic sort of British explorer who's always going off somewhere very dangerous and very far from that nobody else has done before. And then he comes back and goes and climbs another mountain or goes to Antarctica or something. So he's actually, Georgie is his heir. And he has said, well, think of this house as your home, your own, because it's stupid to have it empty all the time. So Georgie suddenly finds herself in a very nice country house with staff, the first time. Having lived on baked beans and tea for a long time, this is really rather nice.
It's not only rather nice, but unusually for Georgie, it's comfortable. I mean, she has spent a lot of time freezing to death in the Scottish castle, or inherited rather. He's the heir by her brother, who's the Duke of Rannoch. And the penalty there is that the brother's wife, Fig, as she is known. Yeah. Why is it that the British aristocracy bestowed these ridiculous nicknames on people all the time?
I don't know whether it's probably because people had such long, complicated names. You know, someone might be called, you know, Hermione Esmeralda. But anyway, it's not bestowed in the past. My husband, who has a claim to British upper class, we have all sorts of cousins with ridiculous names. We do have a Fig, which is where I stole it from. I don't know if she knows. I don't think she reads, but I stole it from her. We also have a Dude. We have a Puff. Now, Puff is a very distinguished elderly lady who's really, I think, Lady Virginia. But everybody says, oh, it's Puff coming to tea. Oh, here she is. And so, you know, we have all these silly names and they still exist. So I don't know if it's still going on with the new generation now, but certainly the generation who's my age or maybe slightly older than me.
Well, was it a way of, you know, because they were called by their more formal names in formal situations. Yeah. So, I mean, it strikes me that it was also some sort of form of intimacy, you know, that you could call somebody who's actually like Countess whatever, You can call her, or in this case, the Duchess of Van Eyck, but you can call her Fig. That admits you to an inner circle, it gives you a certain status, right?
Another case of them and us, you know, it's us who, and also all those secret little words, you know, things like NCIT, not safe in taxis, you know, all those little underground words that prove that you're one of us or you're not one of us. So that certainly has gone on in England. Well, we know with when poor Duchess Catherine, who I will not call Kate Middleton because she's married to a prince, when she was dating him, they nearly broke up because her mother used the dreaded word toilet instead of lavatory. And toilet is a lower class word, and lavatory is what the upper class say. And so it was all over all the newspapers. It was called Toilet Gate. And it nearly broke them up. And it just shows how silly it is in England still that that sort of thing matters. I find it fascinating.
It is fascinating. And, you know, language is kind of the key to it, as you just point out. You know, there's a different language for the upper class, and for a long time, for centuries, most of them are educated at, if you're a man, at Oxford or mm-hmm. Cambridge, where, you know, they all previously at either Eton or Harrow, or there's a Catholic school in Lancashire, the name of which I can't remember, but it starts with an A.
Ambleforth. But my husband, who went to Downside, will tell you that Downside is the premier one and Ambleforth is the next one. They argue over it.
But anyway, very much, you know, very much a club kind of an environment, just as in that there, London was filled with clubs to which gentlemen belonged. And, you know, the club that you belonged to made you a member of a certain tribe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole label language thing that goes on among the upper classes, and it's virtually impossible for anybody to break into it. One of the things I love about Georgie's mother is she just doesn't bother.
Yeah, well, she's, you know, she has, I suppose she was very famous before she married the Duke, and now she tends to forget that she's not married to the Duke anymore. And when she goes to certain shops like Harrods, they all always say Your Grace, and she doesn't correct them. She likes that still.
Well, good for her. She's actually a Dowager Duchess, right? Because
Dowager Duchess, yes.
Duke died, right. Yeah. So anyway, Ainslie House in Sussex is where Georgie, and she's now married to her longtime suitor, Mr. O'Mara. One thing I'm meaning to ask you, is there income that comes along with Ainslie House, or is Darcy making enough money for them to lead some sort of reasonable life there?
I think the income is coming in that Sir Hubert has set up a bank, a trust there, so that there's enough each month to pay the servants and pay for the food. So, you know, we can keep our heads, we can keep ourselves going on what he's got. And Darcy does make money. We just don't know how much and whether it's regular or where it comes from, really. We suspect he's some sort of spy, but he's never actually come out and said it.
Right. Well, he does secret missions.
He does secret missions. Yeah.
Disappears and doesn't try. He's kind of an early version of the Official Secrets Act that you hear about in World War II.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So anyway, here's Georgie, who, you know, survived on tea and toast for forever, had to cage food, tried to set herself up to clean people's houses and so forth in order to survive. Yeah. It wasn't always the case that if you were from an aristocratic family, if you weren't the heir, that you had any money. And so, you know, I'm happy to see that she's achieved some level of comfort.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't keep her suffering for too long. I mean, the thing, too, is that there are various things. Her father lost the rest of their fortune in the Great Depression. And so Binkie has had to sell off a lot of the estate for death duties, which are the estate taxes. And so Fig claims they don't have any money to give Georgie. What do you do if you're a young girl of good family and you really haven't been educated to do anything other than marry well? And so she's turned down a Romanian prince at one stage. They would like to get her married off to the right sort of person. Instead, she's married Darcy and very happy about it. And now they're quite settled, which I think is really nice, is that she doesn't have to worry every meet where the food's coming from. She just has to worry how it's cooked, because Queenie is now her cook.
That's right. potential for disaster at every turn. So yes. Anyway, here's Georgie in this new environment, and she thinks that it would be lovely to have a Christmas house party to, you know, celebrate settling into her home and her marriage and so forth. But everybody she asks is already committed. And but gradually, Reese is so sneaky, gradually, there are a few people who decide out of the blue that they will spend Christmas with Georgie and Darcy. And then what happens? Because that's really where we need to go.
Yeah, well, not exactly the people she would have chosen to spend Christmas with her, in that her brother and sister-in-law suddenly come and park themselves upon her because the boiler has burst at Castle Rannoch. And as Fig said, you have this lovely new house now all to yourselves. So we thought we'd come and have a nice cozy Christmas with you. Well, Georgie isn't too thrilled, but she can't say no. So she's the thought of just Fig and Binky, and well, she brings her grandfather, her lovely Cockney grandfather, he comes, but that's hardly a Christmas house party that she would relish. At the last moment, Mummy shows up, having left Germany in a huff. And so there's a few people there, but then they get a letter from Darcy's strange aunt Ermyntrude. All we know about Aunt Ermyntrude is that she gave them a painting for their wedding. And it's a very disturbingly strange painting. And apparently she's an artist. And she says that she's moved from her bleak house in Yorkshire to a house on the Sandringham estate. Well, we know Sandringham is where the royal family celebrates Christmas. And it turns out that she was once a lady in waiting to Queen Mary. Who knew? I mean, Georgie's always thought she was sort of this arty type who trails scarves, but it turns out she was a lady in waiting. And so she's on the Sandringham estate now, and she says, I'd love to have young people around me for Christmas, and I think we could do a little house party. So Georgie is relieved of the task of having to feed and look after these people, rather delighted. But there's a sort of hint in the invitation, and she says, oh, Queen Mary is really looking forward to seeing dear Georgiana again. And when Darcy reads this, he says, I think this is a summons in disguise. And Georgie said, the Queen has summoned Georgie several times before, and it's never been good. It's always been some sort of little task she wants Georgie to do. So Georgie thinks, oh, golly, what does she want this time? But anyway, they're going to Norfolk. They're going to the Sandringham estate. There's going to be plenty of good food and Christmas cheer. And what more could she want?
Right. But of course, that's way too simple and optimistic. an adventure. So Aunt Ermyntrude is a widow. Her husband died in an unfortunate accident.
Yes.
She wasn't particularly happily married. So for people who aren't familiar with the concept of a grace and favor house, which is what Aunt Ermyntrude is currently living in, why don't you explain that?
Yeah, well, the royal family owns, well, Sandringham itself, Sandringham Estate, you have the big house. It's not a palace. It's just a big sprawling country house. And then you have several other properties on the estate. One of them, William and Kate live in at the moment. And so you have these various houses in various parts of the country owned by the royal family, and they can give them to somebody to live in during their lifetime. I think the former royal butler, Queen Mother's royal butler, was given a grace and favor property. And so you can live in this without paying rent. And in this case, it's on the estate or at the edge of the estate. So she would be nicely close to Queen Mary to keep her company. So it works rather well.
It does work rather well. What they mostly were what's called by the British a life tenancy, meaning, mm-hmm. you know, the royal family, because this is property that just belongs to the family. It is not official property, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
In their apartments at Hampton Court, for example, there are grace and favor apartments.
There are many, yeah.
Yep. And so they're given to somebody, and it's like it's a life tenancy. When that person dies, or maybe is ill and has to be removed to a nursing home, or gets married and departs, or whatever happens, then it becomes vacant for a next person. Yeah. So it isn't that the person was given the house. What the person was given was an opportunity to live in the house,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. And the ones at Hampton Court, a lot of those were former servants, you know, someone who's a former nanny or something. They were fairly small, but this is a very nice house. So, you know, she's done quite well to have this. It's It's big enough for a house party, swimming pool and room for a pony, as they would say in Hyacinth's bouquet. But no, I mean, it's a nice country house, and it's not that far from the main house at Sandringham. So we're within close reach of the royal family, which is one of the reasons I wrote this.
Right. Well, traditionally, the royal family, at least this royal family, spend Christmas at Sandringham. Now, I was in England, oh gosh, it was over 20 years ago, and it was in the summer or spring. So the house was open for public tours. Eventually, actually, but I was there with Deborah Crombie. I can't remember if you were part of that, when they opened Buckingham Palace. For the opportunity for
you can do that.
I think it was Deborah Crombie and a friend of ours called Catherine and I went to Buckingham Palace and took one of the early public tours. But anyway, Sandringham House, I mean, it's not a castle, it's not a palace. Yeah. It's a big, it's just, and I remember there was a lot of dark wood. And it's very very country kind of, you know, not pretentious, not particularly fancy.
That's it. It's got a long, long, dark corridor going down the middle, and lots of rooms that really aren't that big. You know, right. A lot of them are wood paneled and the ceilings are wood paneled. So as you say, it's a dark place. And from the outside, it's not actually, it looks like bits have been added onto it, doesn't it? It doesn't look like anybody has designed it with a concept in mind.
No, I think it looks like a house that might have started out smaller and then people added onto it. I really don't know the whole architectural history, but
It was built for the Prince of Wales, Queen Victoria's eldest son. He had it built for his own country estate. So that's when it came.
Well, it explains, if it's Victorian, it would explain why it looks the way it does. Osborne House was also owned by Queen Victoria and was on the Isle of Wight. And then there's a whole Scottish thing that Victoria would go and spend time to.
Yeah.
So, if you go back and look at like Elizabeth or Henry VIII or something, they used to go on tour from royal residences because they would and they would take their whole household with them.
Yeah.
And if some unlucky nobleman was in the path, it could actually bankrupt one of them to have the host, you know, like because Elizabeth, for example, traveled with an enormous retinue, her furniture, her clothes, her horses, you know, whatever. So this is a nicer version where they just go to these places without all that tenure. Anyway, Georgie gets there, and sure enough, she's invited to see Queen Mary, and that's always a trauma for her, isn't it? Partly because she's so afraid that she's going to break or spill something or not back out of the room properly, but also because Queen Mary usually has some idea.
Well, and Queen Mary this time doesn't have an assignment for her. She sort of says she's glad Georgie's here. And she sort of hints that she's not completely happy. And she says, I just sense something's wrong, but she won't say what it is. So, you know, Georgie has no idea what it is, and we might find out as we go along.
Well, it's clear that for Queen Mary that her husband is not doing well. He has what was called at that time a bad chest.
Yeah.
So you're pretty sure that pneumonia or something similar is coming for him.
Yeah.
And in fact, during the book, he does participates in a couple of outdoor hunts. But for those of you who know your history, he died in January of 1936, but we're still in December of 1935. You know, Reese, I wondered, you know, I mean, aside from Queen Mary's grief at losing her husband and so forth, I've often thought about this. If you're queen, or if you're a duchess, or if you're any of these things, when your husband dies, all of a sudden, you know, you're not anymore. You become a dowager, you become the queen mother.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're used to being a queen, I'm wondering if part of this is Queen Mary contemplating the changes in her own life when George dies and her son David, who is a risky proposition at best, becomes king.
I think that you hit on the main thing there is that obviously, she will have a nice life and be respected, but she's desperately worried about David because he has proved himself to be a lightweight. He's the ultimate part. He's Peter Pan, you know, he's in his 40s now, but all he likes to do, he loves to go onto somebody's yacht. He loves to go for weekend parties with his friends. He doesn't want to buckle down and be king ever. And then there's the added specter of Mrs. Simpson. Now, the thing I found fascinating is that nobody in England, the average person in England, knows nothing about her, because the press all had a gentleman's agreement not to mention her. In the foreign press, if you were over in Switzerland, you'd know, or America, you'd know about her, but nobody in England does. The ordinary person doesn't know about her. And Queen Mary cannot believe that he'd want to marry her, because obviously as king, he can't. When he's king, he's the head of the Church of England. And that means the Church of England does not condone divorce. So there's no way he can marry a twice divorced woman. It just couldn't happen. But another interesting thing I found when I was researching was that she was really rather naive. She really believed that when he became king, he could issue some sort of decree and change the law so she could be queen. She really thinks she's going to be queen one day. So naturally, Queen Mary is desperately worried about this. And, you know, when he does become king, the old queens, the dowager queen's position in society really depends on him a lot. Which house will he give her? What sort of allowance will he give her? All those things could be horrible. We know when Elizabeth became queen, how very good she was to her mother. And her mother lived in Clarence House, and they were so close. They met together for their gin and tonics every day. And, you know, it was a very lovely relationship, but not always the case. In the past, it's been the tower and your head cut off, but not anymore.
Well, you know, David, I mean, the Prince of Wales is really a fascinating character. I mean, before Mrs. Simpson, he did have a couple of mistresses that were well known. He might have had even more, as a matter of fact, one of whom was Emerald Cunard, who made the mistake, in fact, of sailing off to America with her sister, a Vanderbilt, asking Mrs. Simpson to look after David while she was gone. We'd talk about inviting, you know, a snake into your nest.
Wow. Absolutely. She used the famous words, "Take care of the little man for me, will you?" Well, Wallace Simpson did take care of him very well.
Indeed, she did. But anyway, I mean, he was, you know, when he was Prince of Wales, he was sent on a couple of world tours. You know, he had mistresses, and it looked as though there was some promise. He was actually fairly, I think, well known and kind of respected when he, you know, in the 20s.
He had abundant charm. He was very great with the ordinary people. He'd go around, like in times of a dock strike or something, he'd go around and he'd be one of them talking to them, and they'd all think he was wonderful. So he did have that great boyish charm. And of course, every woman in England was adoring in the 20s. You know that song, "I Dance with the Man Who Danced with the Girl Who Danced with the Prince of Wales"? Right. You know, they all loved him. But he hasn't developed from the 20s, and he's still the little boy who likes to play. And even when he's king, we know one of the first things he does is go off on his yacht for a month or so, not even looking at the papers, you know, the royal dispatch box is the way he's supposed to. So the Queen Mary is duly worried that when he becomes king, it will be the end. I mean, in his 40s, he's not married, he doesn't have an heir. It's a very worrying situation.
Well, I mean, it's impossible to go back and, you know, do any kind of real psychoanalysis of somebody who died long ago. But, you know, you do have to wonder. I think Peter Pan is a really good description of him, Reese. And I wonder, you know, if Mrs. Simpson didn't represent his opportunity to actually duck the whole thing. I think in his heart, he had to know that he was never going to be able to marry her and stay on the throne. Mm-hmm. And it may be that it was, in a way, almost a face-saving thing. He didn't want to say, you know, "I just don't want to do the job."
No.
But he had an opportunity with Mrs. Simpson to come up. "I can't, you know, whatever it is without the support of the woman I love," is his classic line.
That's a very interesting thought. Yeah. I mean, I'd always thought that Mrs. Simpson to him, his mother was very cold and very correct and very remote and clearly disapproved of him for most of his life. So I always thought that Mrs. Simpson represented the mother that he didn't have, you know, and his nanny was very cruel. They had a horrible nanny who used to pinch them and make them cry and things like that. So maybe that she represented the mother he would have liked, you know, she hugged him and she was warm to him, not to anybody else. But
yeah, but I mean, she was really, as you point out, she was really a nasty woman. She wasn't, she wasn't motherly in any way. She was almost boyish. I mean, if you look at her, she looked more like a boy than she did like a woman.
Yeah, she did. I think it was more dominatrix, don't you think? He liked to dominate.
But I've often thought that she really was his ticket out of, he loved being Prince of Wales. He really didn't want to be king.
No, well, who would? I mean, when his younger brother was told he was going to be king, the first thing he did was burst into tears.
Yeah. Well, I mean, George, who did become king when Edward, in December of 1936, when he did his famous pronouncement, didn't have all that charm. You know, those of you who saw the movie, which was wonderful, about how he overcame his stutter and so forth. I mean, it was a terrible responsibility. And then, of course, he was king through World War II, which was horrendous. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, he was intensely shy. He had the stutter, which his father was, as you know, you saw from the movie, his father was horrible about. His father would shout it, "Get it out, boy," you know, which was even worse. And the other thing was, he hadn't been raised to be king. He was very happy in the life that he had. He adored his wife. He adored his children. He would call us four, you know, our little world was just wonderful. And of course, poor Princess Elizabeth, when she was young, before all this happened, she had said to people, "When I grow up, I want to marry a farmer and have lots of horses." That was her dream. And
corgis. Yeah, she loves her little dogs, right?
Yeah, and little dogs. She loved her dogs and her horses, yeah. But her idea of marrying a farmer would have been bliss for her. And of course, they were thrown into not only being king and then later she was queen, but they were thrown into being king in World War II. And he really showed then I think because his wife was this figure of steel, she was, she had strength for both of them, that during the war, they really showed their mettle. They were there everywhere. They wouldn't leave London. The Queen made that famous pronouncement when they wanted to send the two girls to America. She said, "The girls will not leave me. I will not leave the King, and the King will not leave London." So they stayed, and every night there was bombing, they'd be walking around the East End comforting people and talking to people. And then finally Buckingham Palace was bombed and the Queen said, "I'm so glad I can hold my head up now with the people of the East End." So, you know, they were very strong.
They were very strong. And I mean, one of the things that I enjoyed in reading God Rest Ye Royal Gentlemen is how Wallace makes fun of George and his wife Elizabeth and the young princesses who do play a small role in this. And I'm more and more convinced that I'm right about Edward and why he was attracted to Wallace. But I think Wallace, as you say, she actually thought she was going for the gold ring, you know, that she was going to be queen. And and actually having to marry him and live with him, not being queen, was a really interesting punishment for her, because there was no way she could avoid it once it got to that point.
And I mean, what a miserable life they both had. There they were. I mean, they deserved each other and they got each other.
Yep.
First of all, they sent him off to the Bahamas because obviously Hitler, he was a big devotee of Hitler, so was she. And so Hitler would like to have brought him to invaded England and put him on the throne as a puppet king. So to stop that happening, they send him to the Bahamas, which is nicely near the coast of America, so submarines can patrol and make sure he stays there. But then after the war, they've got this life in Paris, which, you know, there's nothing for them to do. She goes shopping for clothes and drags him along, and he goes to the club and reads the English papers every morning. And you saw, I think in the movie, I mean, in the TV series, The Crown, you saw him watching the coronation on that little TV set, and you realized how much he realizes what he's given up.
Very true. Well, I won't draw any parallels to Harry and Meghan. We'll pass on from there. I do think that you need to know all this to really appreciate the dynamics of the house party at Sandringham in Gertrude's house, because The people who show up there are in fact Edward and Mrs. Simpson. Oh, yeah. And you realize that the house party that Aunt Ermyntrude has invited everybody to is really just sort of a front for the idea that the Prince of Wales wanted to have Wallace at Sandringham for Christmas, but there was absolutely no way she could ever have been invited into the family. And I love the way you portray her as the outsider. You know, she's so resentful that you know, she can't have all the royal perks and so forth. And I mean, do you know whether that actually happened or did you just make all that up?
Well, that she was part of the house party. No, that was made up. But I know they were skiing in Switzerland and brought back because the father's health was very rapidly declining. So they come, Edward comes rushing back to Sandringham. And obviously, I don't know whether Wallace would have stayed in London, but I just thought it would be fun if he wanted her very close by.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. And so this is a murder mystery. So in point of fact, there is a death and there has been a death before all this happens a year or so ago. And that's all we're going to say about the murder, because otherwise we're going to spoil this book totally. I just, I didn't mean to be tiresome about all this, but I think if you're not actually a student of the period and of the family, a lot of the fun of the book will be lost because you won't know the relationships.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah.
You must have had a ball writing this book.
Well, you know, it's lovely to write. They asked me to write another Christmas book because obviously I'd done a book called The 12 Clues of Christmas, which had sold very well for them. So they said, oh, would you do another Christmas book? And I thought, oh, this Christmas, this is the Christmas that George V is going to die right after Christmas. So we have to be with the royal family. And I thought, yeah, that would be, you know, the thing about writing a Christmas mystery is you can set up this lovely old English Christmas. You can have the crackling Yule log and the carol singers and the flaming pudding and charades and all the silly games that you play in England, used to play in England at Christmases. And you can have all that lovely warm atmosphere, like, isn't this wonderful? I just love. And then, of course, you bring a death into it. And the reader suddenly realizes this is a wonderful time and I'm not safe. And I think so you're doubly hit when something bad goes wrong.
You know, that's a really wonderful insight. And one thing that you do, which I thought was very well thought out, is that you refer, in fact, to the earlier, because it was another Darcy O'Meara aunt who hosted the party. For the last time they did, for your earlier Christmas mystery.
Don't ever stay with Darcy's aunts at Christmas. Nothing, no good can come of it.
Right. And so I thought that was fun that you referred back to it. And in that book, there actually were 12 deaths, weren't there?
Yeah, one every day, yeah.
Yeah, so fewer murders in this one, but very, very interesting. So let's talk about the food. I mean, I think the food is so much fun in this book. Is this... you know, your own experience of food, or did you look into menus that people used to eat?
Well, I think English Christmas food is something that I really crave now. You know, living in America, I try and do a lot of the English Christmas food, in that my mother always made little baby sausage rolls and mince pies that you had with a glass of something, you know, like a warm sort of drink of some sort. And if people came around, you'd immediately offer them mince pies and sausage rolls and some sort of, you know, a sherry or a hot mulled wine or something. So I make those every year. And we have quite a big family and they're all going to be together this year. There's going to be 15 of us again. So that means an awful lot of mince pies and sausage rolls making. So that will be busy. But, you know, the rest of the food in our family, I don't know how one ate it all, because we would have a full English breakfast. And then about 2 o'clock, we would have the turkey with the stuffing and, you know, the chestnut stuffing and the sausage stuffing and various vegetables and the lovely crispy roast potatoes. And then we would have the flaming Christmas pudding, which in those days we made our own puddings. And you would put these little, I think I've still got the bag of silver charms that went into the pudding. You'd put these little silver threepenny pieces and silver charms in the pudding. And then if you got one in your slice, it was a fortune telling what was going to happen to you that year. Like if you got the boot, you were going to travel. If you got the button, you're going to remain a bachelor, the bachelor button. So, all, you know, all those little things were a lot of fun. You had to eat very carefully so you didn't swallow one of these silver bits. But, you know, so all of those things. I love writing about food. I've had so many people, they always write, they say to me, oh, you know, do you love to cook? And I say, no, I hate to cook, but I love to eat. So, you know, all my other books, like the Venice Sketchbook and the Tuscan Child and things, they all revolve around food. And so I obviously, you know, someone suggested I did the Rhys Bowen cookbook one day. Who knows, I might do that.
Well, I think the menus are fascinating. I mean, and, you know, they're absolutely loaded with carbohydrates and so forth. And I wonder, you know, people were able to eat a lot more because they were physically so much more active. You know, they were out riding or they were out walking or they were playing, you know, well, not at Christmas, they weren't playing tennis, but they're out on a shoot and all. But at the same time, the amount of food and drink that is available, I never figured out how anybody kept their figure.
Well, you know why? Because the houses were so darned cold. Ooh. I grew up in a house with long I used to roller skate down the corridors, which shows you they were pretty long. And we had no central heating. We would have a big fire in our main drawing room. And there would be, the kitchen was wonderful because there was a boiler in one corner. But my parents had a gas fire that they would turn on in their bedroom. But the rest of us froze. You know, I'd have a little electric fire beside my bed. And, you know, I would undress very rapidly and get into bed with the big hot water bottle. But there was sometimes ice on the inside of my windows. So you burn a lot of calories that way.
Well, that's true. I hadn't really thought about that. You know, years and years ago, when I was in England, I went to visit the daughter and son-in-law of a family that I was very fond of in Lancashire, who were very nice to me. And they lived in Scotland, I think they actually lived on Loch Lomond, and he had some sort of family. It wasn't, they weren't aristocrats, but they were moneyed. And so they had a family place, and it was May, and it was absolutely freezing in the house. But the tradition of the family was that they turned off the heat, whether it was a boiler or furnace, whatever it was, on the 1st of May. That was it.
Oh,
regardless
yeah.
of the weather. Yeah. That was the tradition. Heat goes off. And I was so cold that I was in the bathtub. Fortunately, they hadn't turned off the hot water. A great deal of the time just trying to stay warm. I didn't have the kind of clothes that you really needed, you know, to be, because I mean, it was May, right? It didn't even occur to me.
We had to stay with my parents-in-law, and they had a new house built on the estate of my sister-in-law, that she had very big grounds, and they sort of bought half an acre and put this lovely new house on it, and with central heating. And I would go and stay with them, and my father-in-law would say, oh, it's splendid, we haven't had to turn on the central heating yet this year. And I'm wearing two undershirts, three pairs of tights, you know, I can't keep warm, whatever it is. They're very hardy. And also that whole thing about sleeping with the windows open. My parents always slept with the windows open. You were supposed to in England, it was healthy. Even though if it's a gale coming in, you kept the windows open.
Got it. So what you're saying is that people burned up a lot of calories just trying to keep warm. And then of course, as I say, you know, if you go back and read Jane Austen, you realize that people walked an enormous amount in Pride and Prejudice. I think it was like 2 or 3 miles between the Bennet's house and remember when the older sister is put to bed and you know, they would walk back and forth. It was perfectly normal for them to do that. So if you figured out that people were on horseback all the time or they were walking all the time or driving a carriage, which, you know, for men, which took an enormous amount of energy too. They just burned up a lot more calories.
But the interesting thing is, if you look back at menus at, say, in Jane Austen's time or Queen Victoria's time, they ate an enormous, I mean, there would be course after course after course, you know, there would be the fish followed by the fowl, followed by the baron of beef, followed, you know, I mean, it just, I hope they just had a tiny bit of each, but they're really
well. I think they must have reason. You know, I live with a foodie, and when we travel, that's his. You know, Rob's always like, we used to fax, and now we can email ahead to make reservations and so forth. And we've eaten at a number of restaurants where there are like 11 courses are in Peru with my brother-in-law. It was up in the 20s or something. Yeah. But everything was just a little tiny. I mean, you could barely taste it. Yeah. And I mean, if you think about Victorian women laced into those, you know, remarkable undergarments and so forth, they couldn't expand enough to actually eat. And so they must have just had tiny little tastes of everything.
Yeah. Well, the one exception to that was Queen Victoria herself, because she read my book, which was called Above the Bay of Angels. She's in her last years, and I saw her dress, and the dress is actually as wide as she was tall. And they're very worried about her because she gorges herself all the time. No one can stop her from eating, and she's getting wider, and she can't really walk properly. She has to be assisted because she's so darn heavy now. And she, if you see her menus, they had all of these courses, you know, for breakfast, there would be pork chops and there would be kidneys and there'd be all these spread out all over the table, and she would just gorge herself. But
well, she was a highly sexed woman, as we well know, and she lost her husband way too early. Yeah. And I've often thought that she ate like that in part for compensation. And then, you know, maybe she was just greedy. I also have wondered if tea gowns were not in fact designed to let women out of this incredibly restrictive underwear into something loose and flowing, so they could actually have tea and really eat something. And I then think maybe that was the one meal that they actually ate to sustain themselves, and everything else was just kind of nibbles.
Well, tea is always my favorite thing in England. You know, proper tea in the old days was, you know, you'd have your tea and you'd have little tiny finger sandwiches and you'd have a nice Victoria sponge and some scones and everything. It's a delicious meal. And the nice thing about entertaining with tea is you, as a hostess, it was just there on the table. You didn't have to get up and do things. You just had to pour the tea and pass around the plates. So it was a delightful meal. And I sometimes have tea still. If I've got friends who are coming over, I say, come to tea. And then I get out my nice Wedgwood china and we have a lovely tea.
It is nice. You can do morning coffee too, sort of on the same principle. It is lovely. So Rhys, this is God Rest You Royal Gentlemen. And we've already said that next Wild Irish Rose. So tell us what comes after or between these two.
Nothing between them, but my next big standalone will come out sometime next summer, and we have a title and we're debating on the cover, and it takes place in World War II in the Blitz and the bombing, and it's called Where the Sky Begins. And
Nice title.
I think it's going to be a fabulous cover to it. We're just debating on it at the moment. And then I've just started writing the next Georgie book, and now we've moved ahead until April, and I thought it would be fun if Georgie goes to see her friend Belinda, who has gone back to Paris. She's studying with Chanel. And so Georgie will go with her husband Darcy on a little trip to Paris. She thinks it's a nice little jaunt. Of course, it won't turn out to be that if she's going with her husband. But we have all the lovely Paris fashion scene. And we also have a young man living in the house who is an American writer. So we might be invited to Gertrude Stein's. And I don't know if Hemingway might just be passing through on his way to the Spanish War. We'll have to see.
Oh, what fun. You know, I hope you're just going to creep your way through 1936. I mean, you know, once you get to 1939, this whole thing would have to change so much.
You're so right. People are saying, are you going to take it up to the war? Wouldn't it be fun if Georgie and Darcy do some spying together? And I think that would change the tone entirely, because, you know, this is a fun romp. I mean, we do have some murders and we do have some spying sometimes, but essentially I want people to chuckle and enjoy it. And the moment you get to World War II, you don't enjoy things anymore. It's deadly serious, you know? So I think we are moving ahead quite slowly, I hope.
Good. Well, there's no reason not to. I mean, you know, if you're writing historical fiction and you're not writing in real time, there's no reason that you can't. I remember Lindsay Davis's first two Roman books, the second one picked up within hours of the first book ending. I thought how clever she was, you know, to do that, because if you advance too fast, you're going to run out of the road that you started out on.
I did that with four funerals and maybe a wedding. I finished with their wedding, going off to their honeymoon. And then I picked up again in the Love and Death Among the Cheetahs. I picked up on the same boat 2 days later on their honeymoon. So,
yes, you did. And actually, I think that's your darkest book in the whole series. You might not agree with me, but I thought it was.
Love and Death Among the Cheetahs. Yeah, it was. It was a bit of a shocking book in many ways. I mean, not only the behavior, but also the motivations.
Yeah, no, there was a lot of social commentary in it. I mean, it wasn't heavy or anything, but it was definitely a darker book. So I think going to Paris and fashion and the House of Chanel and all that would be absolutely wonderful. Why don't we call Patrick up to see if we have questions from the audience or if Patrick wants to ask questions of his own?
Let's see here. You know, not a lot of questions. People just saying how much they love your books. They're chiming in about tea and all sorts of things. There is, Nicole says, I've listened to all your fantastic books through Audible. Will Jasmine Blackborrow narrate your new book?
She will, yeah. It's coming out the same Tuesday, next Tuesday as ever. And yes, she's, or when the books are about to be recorded, Jasmine always gets in touch with me and says, how do you want to pronounce this? And how do you want to pronounce that? Which is very nice. So we get things right.
Let's see. Well, someone asked, will World War II ever happen in the books? And you just talked about that.
I did. I'd like to keep us before World War II, because I think once we've got a war, you know, it's, the thing, there are things like Hogan's Heroes, which were funny, but to me, there was a slightly bad taste in my mouth about the whole of that. And I can't see having funny things with Georgie and Queenie when so many people are dying. You know, it's just...
No, you really can't. And, you know, much as I love Jackie's book and Maisie Dobbs, they've really changed, you know, with the war. You can't put people through the Blitz in London and be funny. You know, it's not amusing. No. Anymore. It's really the same problem as people who wrote Edwardian, mystery. And you know that World War II is coming, and that whole gilded life is going to be smashed to bits. And it's going to completely change the tone of any series that, I mean, Tasha and I have talked about it with Lady Emily, and, you know, Tessa Arlen ran into that. I don't think you can write amusingly about war.
No. And I mean, especially World War I, because before that you had, well, the Edwardian age, you had this age of great elegance and leisure and plenty of time. And we know my place in society, and my place is quite secure in society. And suddenly you've had, I mean, after World War I, nothing would ever be the same again. You, for one thing, you had a whole generation of young men who didn't come back. So, you know, it really changed the way everybody thought. After that, nobody thought the world was safe anymore.
Very true. And actually, we're living through a kind of similar experience at the moment, not with war, but, you know, with disease, reminding us that for all the advances we've made, it's the world is not a safe place.
That's very
Patrick,
true.
Anything else?
Yeah, a whole bunch of them just came in.
Oh, good.
Let's see. Sabrina's asking, or wait a minute, maybe it's not Sabrina. I'm sorry. Yes, it is. How many books do you write in 1 year? And just to, as an add-on to that, you're so prolific. How do you get the work done? You must have quite a work ethic.
Yeah, I'm crazy. I need to be in a straitjacket. But no, I normally write 2 books a year. And I write one of the Royal Spinis, and I have been writing one of the big standalones too. Last year and this year, I've done another Molly Murphy book with my daughter. And so that's meant 2.5 books, which really is pushing it a bit. I'm hoping I can gradually step back more and more, so Claire takes over more of the work in the Molly Murphy series, so I can go back to my 2 books a year. I've tried to slow things down. I've said to my publishers, you know, how about if I do a book every 18 months? And they go, no. So it's very hard to say no. And then they offer me really nice contracts, so I really can't say no. But no, I do work hard, and I do have a, what I do is I try to get the first draft, especially of the Royal Spinis, done in 3 months. So I know if I do about 5 pages a day, I know that I can get that done. So I make myself do about 1500 words a day, and I won't let myself get up and go until they're done. And some days that's really easy and I charge ahead. And other days it's like pulling teeth and I get up and walk around the house and throw a load in the laundry and, make some coffee. But if I know I can't leave the computer, can't turn the computer off till I've done 5 pages, I do 5 pages. And then the next day, the first thing I do is I edit those 5 pages before I go ahead. So that way you never stare at a blank screen. Once I'm through the first draft, I tend to go, okay, that good, that's that done. And then I can go through and edit at leisure because I know I've got my basis, I've got my framework.
So the book really comes alive in the editing process. I mean, getting out the first draft is laying out the plot so you know that things are going to work and all. What do you do in the rewrite? Is it deepening the characters?
No, I find often that I have not... when I want to forge ahead, especially with the exciting parts, I have not set the scene enough. So I think, well, where are we in this room? What do we see? What would she smell? What would, all those things. So then I go through and I bring it to life then a lot more.
Got it.
Let's see. Kathleen asks, I lost it. Is part of the feud between Mrs. Simpson and Georgie's mother due to the successful way that Georgie's mom became part of the in crowd, while Mrs. Simpson is still clearly an outsider?
Oh, what a very good question. I think Mrs. Simpson, to start with, thought that Georgie's mother was someone she could put down the way she's put down other people, because Georgie's mother, of course, has been a bolter. She's been with many men. And so she's not established and safe in a nice marriage. And so Mrs. Simpson thinks she's someone she can tease and needle, but she underestimates Georgie's mother, who's grown up in a London small house and has got that Cockney fighting spirit, which is still there in spite of the fact that she has a lovely smooth accent now, because she's an actress, when she underestimates, so then from now on, battle lines are drawn, and every time they meet, they love to give barbs to each other. And I think Georgie's mother often comes out on top, which I'm very happy about.
She does. Well, you're in charge, so I mean, you can obviously make it work that way. I don't know if we emphasized enough what a wonderful role that Georgie's Cockney grandfather. I mean, what a nice Christmas that he ends up having, which I really like. And also Queenie goes to the house party, yes, in Sandringham, where she has an opportunity to wreak mayhem. And she has a particularly wonderful scene with Mrs. Simpson, which people will really enjoy. I certainly did.
That was a favorite scene, yeah.
Yeah, great.
The grandfather is really one of my favorite characters. He's just, you're so glad that Georgie's had him, because she's grown up in a fairly remote, she's got a nice nanny, but there's no one really apart from that who has hugged her and who has loved her. And that's her grandfather loves her unconditionally. And he's an old Cockney gentleman. He's wise and he's warm. And he's just the sort of person you'd like to have around you.
He doesn't have that icy reserve.
No, doesn't have any.
Well, no, he does. That's not fair. He actually does. It's just a different kind of reserve, and that comes out in the book.
Yeah, I mean, he's a little unsure. He never feels quite at home when he's around. Even though Georgie would love to have him there all the time and everything, he's very aware that he doesn't fit in anywhere. He doesn't fit in with the upper class, and he's not one of the servants. So where does he belong? So he's a little bit uneasy.
Pauline has the cryptic question, will we end with a baby?
Oh, well, I think you probably have to keep reading my books into the future before you find out that.
Cheryl asks, do you always know how a book will end when you start writing?
No. When I start writing a book, I always know in which environment I'm going to set it. Georgie's going to go to Sandringham House and be close to the royals. And I know that the king's death is coming up ahead of us. And I know there's going to be some murders, but I don't know the denouement. I don't really know how we're going to find out. Usually I know who done it. Sometimes I haven't known till the end, until someone says, "Are you a stupid person? It wasn't me at all." And I go, "Oh, I'm sorry." Usually I know, but I'm not one of those people who outlines. I sort of know where we're going and then I follow them and let them go. And Barbara was saying, well, I'm in charge. I'm really not in charge. These people go off on their own and I have to just run to keep up sometimes. You know, I have no idea what mummy's going to say to Mrs. Simpson next. And it's really kind of fun because I think if I'm surprised, then you're surprised.
Very true.
Do you still have the same, relentless schedule, do you have the same amount of time to research that you might have earlier?
The thing is, I'm up to, this is book 15. And the same with Molly. Molly is now book 18. Over the books, I have done meticulous research. I've read a lot. I have all the books sitting there on the shelf. You know, I can go and pull a book down about New York and check what the name of the fire chief was in 1906. I've got a big basis of research now. So it's just looking up the odd thing. Like, you know, I printed out the big plan of Sandringham Estate and decided where I was going to put this fictitious house. So when they'd walk through the woods, et cetera. So it's just little things research now, because I know what Mrs. Simpson would say, and I know what Sandringham House looks like. And, you know, so I come with a basis of knowledge now, which makes it much easier.
You're intimately, you know, familiar with their world.
Yeah. And you know, that's very nice, because I've always, when I started writing the royal family, I made a vow then that I would only have them say things I know they would have said. So it's not like taking a character and making them into a sleuth like other people have done. I know what Queen Mary thought about Mrs. Simpson, and I know what she thought about her son. So when they say something, it really is something they either did say or would have said.
Let me add that, I mean, Reese and I have been together throughout her writing career, and I can remember going all the way back to Molly Murphy's first book. And then we did talk about the kind of research that Reese would do, reading advertisements in newspapers, for example, and things like that, to really get a feeling of it. And, you know, gradually over the years, we've talked less about that because, as you say, you've absorbed it.
Yeah, I've had, you know, when I'm working with Claire, she'd have to say, well, what would they have to dinner? And I say, well, I'll send you some restaurant menus so you know what things people really love to eat. And I've got a disc with the Sears catalog of 1900 on it. So you can see how much everything cost. And you could buy a house for £800. So, you know, it's very interesting to see those sort of things. And I think that's where some people writing historicals really slip up for me. I've noticed I've been reading a book and someone will say some sort of amount of money. And I think, no, that was way too much. You could feed a family for a year on that, you know. So it's very good to know exactly what things cost and how much people earned and things like that. And I do know that sort of thing now.
You know, that was a glaring error in Sanditon. If you watch the television adaptation, the amount of money that was floating around in that book was just ridiculous. Yeah. Nobody had anything approximating that amount of money, but yeah. The lower amount of money was just as useful then as the larger amount of money.
Yeah. What did they get in Sense and Sensibility? Did they get £100 a year in the end?
Something like that. In this 80,000 pound fortune that's floating around in Sanditon. I mean, nobody had that much money. It was ridiculous.
No, I mean, what did Darcy had 10,000 pounds a year. Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe as a good final question, Betty asks, are there any other eras in history that fascinate you that you would like to write about?
Yeah, as you can see from my books, I think that first half of the 20th century has always attracted me, because it's almost, you know, I was born at the end of the first half of the 20th century, so I'm linked to it, and my mother and my grandmother, etc., were all part of it. So it's in a way, it's part of me. But then when you look back on it, it's so different in some ways. You know, the fact that if you go back to Molly Murphy, women couldn't vote. Women could be beaten by their husbands. You've got some things that are so close to us and so some things that were so far from us. So that's why I find it fascinating. I adore the Roman era. I wouldn't write about it because it would involve far too much research right now. And I don't think I have the appetite for that amount of research, but I love reading other people's books. You know, we talked earlier about Lindsay Davis, and you know, I've read all her books, and Stephen Saylor, and my friend Jane Finnis. I love because I think Rome was really the closest to us. It wasn't until the 19th century that we actually approximated the sort of civilization there was in Rome. So I just went to see the Pompeii exhibit the other day. And when you see the meticulous workmanship in a beautiful glass bowl that survived from Pompeii, it's amazing.
Yes, absolutely true. Is that, do you think that was it, Patrick?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Well, Reese, what an absolute pleasure this has been. Let's have one more little bang our glass together sort of thing. I wish that we were actually here. A feature of Reese's events at the Poison Pen has been champagne and lovely little things to eat. And so I certainly hope when we get to March, we'll be able to do that. Although maybe what we should be serving is Guinness and, something Irish.
Oh, we do. We'll have, well, Rob will make his soda bread again, right?
Yes, he could definitely do that. That would be absolutely wonderful. Well, I miss you, so I'm glad you're coming back to Arizona before too long, and we have a chance to get together for lunch and catch up on all kinds of things. Yeah. Notice that Reese and I have each dressed in an appropriate Christmas kind of a thing to celebrate here.
I want you to know that I'm suffering on your behalf, because it's actually quite hot in California. So I was trying on all my Christmas outfits thinking, no, I can't wear a sweater, but this is the closest I could come to be Christmassy. So, and luckily it's just cooled down now. It's just getting dark. So that's much better.
Well, you look lovely. I like your new hairdo, which is slightly different.
It's about to be cut tomorrow because I haven't had it cut for a while, but
It looks
Barbara's
good.
Being too anyway, modest. I was just going to say, Barbara's being too modest, too. There's a special little hidden bonus about this new book, isn't there, Reese?
Yes, but let's not reveal what it is. I think it'd be fun if it were a surprise. Now, there is an Easter egg in this book for Poison Pen customers. And when you open your book, you will find out what it was. So what it is, actually, for which I'm extremely grateful to Reese. I really value her friendship. We've been friends for a very long time.
Yeah, we have.
We really have, and it's been an absolute delight.
Yeah, in spite of that we're 39, we've been friends for 30 years.
We have been, because the bookstore turned 32 last Sunday. Right. So, it's been a sort of nostalgic week, for me to think about all the things that, there have been so many wonderful moments and so many things that I treasure, but you are certainly one of them. So thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you. And I look forward to seeing you soon.
And indeed you will. Thank you all. Good night, everybody.
Night, everybody. Good night.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.